Welcome to Crime Corner, where we examine all things crime, whether it be on the page, on the screen, on the street, or in the courtroom. I'm Matt Coyle, author of the Rick Cahill Crime Series, and I'll be your host for as long as it takes. And I'm very happy the intro music worked today. Pretty exciting. My guest tonight, Samuel Gailey, was raised in a small town in northeast Pennsylvania with a strapping population of 379 people. And now Sam resides on a remote island in the Pacific Northwest. Clearly does not get along with others. The Guilt We Carry is his second novel following the critically acclaimed Deep Winter. Gailey's novels are intriguing studies of human nature and portray how the simplest act of fate can alter and shatter lives, and that is so apropos for The Guilt We Carry. Before writing novels, Sam worked in film production and eventually became a screenwriter, writing and developing shows for Showtime and Fox. He lives with his wife and author Anne Gailey and daughter on Orcas Island, where he is a founding member of the Orcas Island Literary Festival. Welcome, Sam Gailey.
Thank you for having me, Matt. I'm excited to be talking to you.
Well, it's not that exciting, but it is for me, though. I'm going to tell a brief story. I'm going to tell a brief story before we get into this stuff, because Sam has been a hero of mine for, I don't know, we were on a panel together. It was after, I think, both our first books. This was a long time ago, but I'd still been on enough panels to know, try not to be a panel hog. I'm probably more of a panel hog now than I was back then by far, but it was a huge, there were probably six authors and a moderator, which is really big for a panel. It was a library thing. Great people. Yeah. At the library were fantastic. It was a great auditorium, except the lights were right in our eyes. But everybody, it was like heavy pontification on the panel. So everybody was just, just going on and on with every question. So we rolled down, and Sam's the last guy on the end of the row. And it was, this is maybe question number 8 or 9, and we probably already about an hour in. And so the moderator, who was very good, asked everybody the same question. So when it gets down to Sam, we've had 5 people pontificating, me maybe a little less than the others, but still, I got my words in. So she goes to Sam, and he goes, you know, I think everybody pretty much covered that question. So I thought, this guy does not have to be heard all the time. And it was go ahead.
Well, yeah, I didn't know you weren't supposed to be honest. I thought you were just, when you're up there, you're just supposed to say, oh, well, I got nothing much to say.
No, grab your time and spew. Grab your time and spew. No, it was endearing to me ever since. But anyway, so The Guilt We Carry is, I don't want you to give away too much. Tell us a little bit about it, but I would not give away if you don't. I don't remember what the book jacket says. If the book jacket gives away the hook, go ahead and give it away. But if it doesn't, just call it an incident, okay? Because I want readers to get full value when they read this. It's such a good first chapter.
Gotcha. Okay. The Guilt We Carry centers on Alice O'Farrell. She's a 15-year-old middle-class kid in North Carolina, a good student, an athlete, and one night something goes horribly wrong at home. It's a tragic accident, and it really devastates the family. Alice runs away from home. She can't bear the guilt. And the story really picks up 6 years later, and Alice has been living on the streets. She's pretty much a train wreck. She's been self-medicating, and she just makes one wrong decision after another. And one morning, she wakes up and next to someone that's no longer alive, and also finds a duffel bag full of money. And Alice sees this as an opportunity to get back on her feet, so she takes the money. And it's really the story is about the next 10, 12 days of Alice on the run from the people that want their money back, and also trying to come to grips with her past and let go of the guilt that she's been carrying for too many years.
Right. I think this. I think back years ago, I think I don't know, any critics or librarians, what have you, bookstore owners, will call this a novel of suspense. I mean, it's very internal about the character. It's really well done, but we pretty much we end up knowing who's chasing her. So it's really, now they call them thrillers, but to me, because I always like the idea of suspense, because there's tremendous suspense in here. And it's not just, whether she gets away or is confronted, what have you. It's also, her her path to possible redemption.
Right.
So, interestingly, though, you are not a 21-year-old woman. You're not even close. So, why did you choose to write?
A long time ago.
Maybe. Well, actually, I don't even want to get into that. but why did you choose to write, be a protagonist, a young woman, when you are clearly not?
You know, I think there's a couple of these. You know, my first story, Deep Winter, 95% of the characters are all male in a small town in northeast Pennsylvania. And I think I was crazy, a little different, kind of try to push myself. And then, honestly, at the time when the story kind of grabbed me, I was living in Los Angeles and driving my daughter to school one day, and I just noticed this younger woman living on the street. She was homeless, and she might have been 17, 18. And I saw her a few times, and she just stuck with me. And I wondered, you know, how did this kid get here? You know, how did someone, you know, we all came from somewhere. We were all raised by at some point. And how did someone like that get there? And that's how it all kind of started, you know, getting together. And, you know, I'm definitely a character-driven writer, and then when I read something, I really love strong characters, and that just compelled me. So it's there's no looking back from there.
Right. It's funny, the spark that can lead to a novel. Are you on a speakerphone or what? You're going in and out.
Oh, I'm on an island. I'll make sure I don't move.
Well, climb a tree.
Is this a little better?
That's better. That's a lot better, actually. That's always a good excuse. I'm on an island.
If you can't hear me, I'm on an island.
Actually, come through great. Now, I'm not going to get too specific on the villain, but he's very interesting, very different. Could be come off as a caricature if not written with the skill that you clearly have.
Thank you.
How he's not just one-sided. He's not a caricature, and
right.
Maybe why he's not.
Right. So how did I get to this guy? How did I?
I don't know. Say whatever
from?
You want. Well, you know, why is he kind of three-dimensional? There is a reason. I mean, there's a reason why he's kind of a nasty guy in some ways. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, in creating this character, I didn't want a stereotypical, I even hate to say drug dealer. He's more of a mover of product. And
right.
I didn't want that stereotype. And in creating this character, you know, I think any villain in fiction or in reality, you know, we're just not born evil. Something happens to us along the way. And Sinclair, he had a very difficult childhood. He, due to a growth hormone issue, he stopped growing at the age of 12 or 13. So he's this very diminutive man, very small, but he's very menacing. And when I was really playing with him and creating him, I really liked the fact that even though he was brutal and would just do ruthless things, on the other hand, he's extremely polite to people in the service industry, and he believes in manners and good reading. He believes in literature and being respectful. So I think that makes someone like that more three-dimensional. You know, they're just not pure evil and greed.
So all you people in the service industry out there, the person who's tipping you well and being a nice guy, you could be a sociopath. Just remember that. Don't go out for drinks.
Exactly.
Don't go out for drinks afterwards. No, he's a very interesting character, and he is menacing, this little guy, he's really well done, and not run of the mill that you see in books like mine. So this is your second book, and as far as I know, I mean, I know Deep Winter and The Guilt We Carry. I don't know if you wrote something earlier, like a long time ago or anything. You didn't, correct?
No, this is my second. I mean, I've written other manuscripts, but this was the second one that I did take out and sell. Yeah.
Okay. So you are on kind of a standalone track. Is there? Do you prefer standalones to series?
You know, it's. I do get that question. It's. I think there's an argument both ways.
I thought it was original.
What's that?
I thought it was an original question, but go ahead.
Oh. No, you know, the way you phrased it is the first time I've heard it phrased like that.
So, perfect.
Yeah, it was
thank
very
you.
Yes. I think there's arguments for, you know, the strength of a series because as a writer, you know, have your main character and the readers become invested in that person, whether, you know, they're a cop or a detective. And I think it builds an audience, and I think it's worked well for you. You know, you've done quite well, and people are really responding to the Rip Cahill series. So I think I admire that.
Check in the mail.
Okay, check in the mail. Buy his books. But I just, you know, I don't – when I get inspired by a story, I guess when I write something, I figure that's the story, and I'm done with it. I move on, and I want something else. So the only thing that my third book, I'm going back to the small town that Deep Winter took place in, and a few characters from Deep Winter return in this new story, this new book. So I'm drawn to that idea. Maybe at some point I'll write a series, but it's not in my wheelhouse at this time.
Well, I think that for me, writing a standalone would be kind of scary. You have to recreate... I mean, not recreate. You have to create a whole new world in some ways. Even though you're going back to a small town, you're using different characters. And I think, honestly, there's challenges to both ways. But I think for me, it'd be a little more scary writing writing standalones than going back to an old familiar character where you can get into his clothes really easily.
I think
that
it does
really
take longer.
It takes longer to develop the story as in a standalone?
I think so. At least it does for
me.
There's a gap in between Deep Winter and this book for different reasons, you know, creatively and business-wise. But I'm hoping my third book will be out in the next year and a half or two. So, but we'll see.
Where are you right now?
I'm about 80% done with this draft. And then I have some readers that my wife, Ann, she reads everything that I do, and she's my first editor. So I think I should be done with the book in the next probably 6 weeks. And then, you know, another few months of tweaking and rewriting, and then share it with all the agents and the publishing people.
Right. Wow. I didn't know you that far along. That's great.
Yeah.
So you have a film background, and for some reason you started writing books, crime books, which they pay so well. I can understand why. So why you went from done some reading about screenwriting and such, which although it's not really you did you so you wrote for TV a little, or you developed shows. Did you ever like write in a writer's room?
I got freelance assignments, so I was never in the writer's room. So I, you know, Ann and I would write episodes of some shows on Fox and Showtime. And then I also had a screenwriting partner where we wrote broad comedies. And just to give you a point of reference of how far I've gone from our one script that got a lot of recognition and won some awards was called Whale Farts.
Oh, of course.
And it was basically a comedic take of Moby Dick. And, yeah, we wrote these very big, broad comedies that did, you know, we sold things that never got produced. And then I guess I just ran out of funny and wanted to go to dark. And now I'm in the dark.
You ran with it. You ran with it.
I did.
So do you ever miss that, even though you weren't in a room with a bunch of other writers, you were working with your wife at times, and you were working with another screenwriter, do you miss that collaborative process coming up? Because obviously writing a novel, although there is collaboration later, but when you're actually writing, you know, sit down, you're all alone.
Honestly, I don't miss that at all. It you know, The difference is, you know, what, you know, I would write for television with partners or by myself. By the time I finished it and it went through the studio system and the showrunner and the director and producers, what I gave them and what ultimately ended up on the screen was dramatically different. And I think when you're writing a novel, it's your vision, your voice, and you work obviously with editors, and they give you some direction, and you know, it always makes it better. But it's your story, it's your voice, and I really like this process of writing novels much better, and I'm very happy with where I'm at right now, for sure.
Cool. So you know, you just kind of sparked something, because there is a clear voice in The Guilt We Carry, but educate me, because I don't write standalones. When is your voice different from book to book when you're writing standalones? I know there's a little time in between the two books, and because voice is obviously very important. Voice is what people can't really put their finger on, but what draws them into stories very often. So how does that, you find a different voice for each book?
I think so. You know, I mean, stylistically with Deep Winter, the first book, each chapter I alternated from each character's perspective. So even the narration would be a little bit different. Danny, the main character, suffered a brain damage when he was six, so he was limited in what he could understand and process, and just in writing it from his perspective was different from his chapters. So, and then with the new one, The Guilt We Carry, you know, Alice, she's in probably 95% of the book, 90% of each, you know, each page, each chapter, so it really is from her perspective, other than Sinclair, the antagonist. So that's the fun for me, is finding, you know, making the voice unique and making each book a little bit different. But I think each writer has their own style, and I think people would see, if they liked one of my books, if they liked Deep Winter, I think they would equally like The Guilt We Carry, because they might appreciate my style, my voice, I hope.
It's been a few years since I read Deep Winter, and so none of the characters were in first person, right? They're all third, right?
Yeah, I always write third person, past tense.
Right.
Yeah.
So, have you ever thought about writing first person?
I have not. I've thought about it, but the thing I like about third person is you can do, you know, you can get into all these other characters' heads and reveal their background, their fears, their motivation. Whereas first person, do you write first person? Do you just stick with that?
I do.
Yeah.
It's easier when you're writing.
Do you find that limiting?
Of course. And when you're writing, you know, I write about death and stuff and, you know, crimes. And so they're always, unless my guy's involved or it's in front of him, it's always off screen, off the page. So it is limiting in some ways, but it's a cheat for me to get into Rick Cahill's voice.
Right.
I'm actually I don't want to give away the book I just turned in, but I have some challenges for the next book. I'm now just starting first and third. But anyway, enough about me. So I asked a stupid question when the two of us were with David Putnam at Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego, and I was interviewing you two, and I thought it was such a brilliant question. I'm going to use it again, even though it's kind of stupid. Brilliant, stupid.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's two questions. We always sort of talk about how the story – I'm going to use it anyway, and I realize how stupid it is. But it kind of sounds like very literary, so here you go. Do you pursue the story, or does it pursue you?
Oh, right. I remember this one. I think I let David go first. Didn't I last time? Also, what did David say? Whatever David said,
Dave just writes about his job as a cop. So the guy was he had a million bus, so he just writes about the next bus. So he cheats.
Okay. So I think my answer, I'll stick with the same answer, is Let's see, do I pursue my story? Does my story? I think the story pursues me. So, like, Deep Winter was, you know, inspired by this young kid that I grew up with. He was suffering some mental limitations, and he was bigger than the rest of his kids, and he was quiet, and we're all kind of scared of him. And I just wondered years later what would happen to someone like him if he was found with a dead body in a small town in northeastern Pennsylvania. How could he defend himself? So I think I see these situations and these characters, and like I mentioned earlier, when I was in L.A., seeing this young girl on the street. So I guess I see this, and then I pursue that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But I think you nailed a really stupid question, but I'm gonna use that every week now, because every 2 weeks.
Okay.
Because it really sounds like I'm kind of thinking about things.
Then you can just kind of sit back and wait for the answer.
Right. I don't listen to answers anyway.
Okay.
So talk about – now you're on an island in the Great Northwest, and yeah. And you have a daughter, and somebody has to be – your wife's hopefully working, making money, because this is the literary biz. So talk about your writing process and your schedule, if you know, just briefly. You can talk process as much as you want, but schedule briefly, or just say whatever the hell you want.
Gotcha. So I'm more of a morning guy. I do have a daughter, so I take her to school every day. And then I typically work from around 9 a.m. to about 1. And I like to write outside, unless it's raining or below about 40 degrees. And so my schedule is, definitely the morning. And then my process, my first draft – and even on my outlining is I write notebooks. So I write the whole story outline, and then when, page 1 to 310, it's all handwritten, because I really just like that process of a notebook and a pen, and I'm not editing myself or restricting myself when if I'm in front of a computer and you type something wrong, you backspace, or you're tempted to jump online and check your email. So I just like that organic process of pen and paper. And then and when I have filled up a bunch of notebooks, I then start to input it into the computer, and I have a natural edit as I input that. And then I'm a heavy edit guy. I probably edit my manuscript 25, 30 times before I show it to my publisher and my agent. So that's my process. Wish I was a little more quick, but it is what it is, I guess.
Yeah, I don't even. What is a notebook? I mean, like you got your Apple notebook?
No. This is like it's parchment paper that's bound together, usually with spiral or staples, and it has two sides, and you write on it, and you write words like cursive, like letters.
Not familiar with that. You write,
yeah.
So you do this in cursive?
I do cursive.
God, you must have very good writing. Do you ever get to the point like, I don't even know what I wrote? That's because I could never do that.
I'm the only one that can read my writing. I mean, what's frightening is if I lose my notebook, there goes chapters 1 through 17.
Can't back
and
that
then,
up.
No, you can't back that up. So, yeah, it's – I guess I'm I like to live dangerously. So maybe that's – I've given up a lot of bad habits, but this is my form of gambling right now.
Oh, that's amazing. I was going to ask what was the most difficult thing about writing a book, but I think I just found out. Having to type it all back in. Well, I mean, writing it out in cursive, but I do see the benefit of obviously not checking your email and whatever, but when you're putting it into, when you're putting it, downloading, whatever, not typing on the computer, because there's just a natural editing process there. So it's different from, because I revise every day what I wrote the day before, but this is, you're actually like moving it from one, thing to another. So I think that's even more open to editing. That's kind of, actually kind of makes sense. And you said that you outline too.
Yeah, I definitely do an outline, so I know where my story starts and where it ends, and I basically, you know, have a description of each chapter, and, you know, but things change, which I'm sure most writers, you know, you, I don't know if you do an outline, or you have an idea of, or do you do an outline, or you just go, you just start and you just fire away?
Clearly you haven't read me, because no, I don't do an outline. It's that would make too much sense. I'd have to be too organized. No, I used to do kind of a skeletal, and now the process has gotten messier with each book. I still do have a target that I'm shooting for at the end, and I've got an exciting incident generally. I don't really have one now in my new book. But no, I don't outline, and I don't worry about it anymore. I think it'd be easier, but you kind of have to follow the process and have faith in it.
Yeah. It's what works for you, you know. But my outlines, you know, they do change eventually. You know, the characters, not to sound too heady, but sometimes the characters evolve as I'm writing them, and they make decisions in the outline form that don't make sense when you're in chapter 38 and you're like, no, that doesn't work. This is how they're going to react, and this is what they're going to say.
Right. I think I'm guessing even people that are strict outliners, that has to happen a little bit. So do you ever see yourself going back to writing for screen?
I think the only way that I would do that, you know, there, I have some interest in both my books right now to adapt them into films.
Wow. Great.
If it was the right situation, I would adapt my own books. You know, it would have to be something like, you know, I'm not going to do it. You know, people always want you to write a spec script, which means, why don't you write me the script for free and then we'll see if we can buy it. So I wouldn't do that anymore. You know, I would have to get paid to write it. Or if there's another screenwriter that I think would have better value and maybe have a better approach and vision in adapting my book, I'm fine with that too. You know, that's what happened with Anne, my wife. Her book was just made into a film, and someone else adapted her memoir and wrote a screenplay. And the changes they made in it, or she even admits that she thinks it made for a better story. So I would go back, but it would have to be certainly under the right circumstances. And like I said, I like writing books. So if I have a book that I really want to work on, you know, that would be a tough decision. But I would probably write the next book rather than a screenplay.
I admire your wife. I think that shows, you know, she acknowledged that somebody else did something that made more sense with the work she'd produced. That's a confident writer that's not insecure. And I think that, because I heard Greg Hurwitz was his latest book came out, and I was at his signing at Mysterious Galaxy, and he talked about how he'd written. He was talking about a movie, actually, one of the movies he'd written the screenplay. He wrote a book a long time ago, came a movie, he wrote the screenplay. And he said there was this big speech the character was supposed to give. And then he realized when he and the director realized when just one look that this actress was giving, pretty much there was no need for the speech anymore. And obviously a guy like Greg has been at it for so long and been, you know, in so many different fields. That's it. I think newer to people to the process would be a little more precious with their work. You know, you can't mess with that, but they really are two different things, aren't they? There's your book, and then when you sell it, it's not yours anymore, and it's a completely different thing. Whatever they do with it, they do with it.
And, you know, honestly, when you're trying to fit a book into 2 hours, you know, I would think that certain characters or flashbacks or other things that I use that were vital in my book in a film, you know, it could be just that look. It could be something else that you know, you do have to trust the other players, the director and the producers and the actors, that you know, they know what they're doing, and they might have to veer off your page a little bit.
Right. So give a plug for your wife. You said that one of her books was made into a movie. Is there anything exciting happening?
Well, her book was a memoir called Pornology, and
it was my life.
years ago, before I was in the picture, someone she was dating accused Anne of being pornophobic. And she realized, well, she had never experienced porn, whether watching it or going to a strip club or these kind of things, that he was right. So she made a porn to-do list, and she decided to explore all these things porn-related. And it's a hilarious book, you know, and she goes through this whole journey, and it's kind of a self-discovery of the good side of porn, the bad side of porn, and everything in between. And so it was made into a movie, and the title now is called A Nice Girl Like You, and it's starring Lucy Hale from Pretty Little Liars, who she's got a huge following, and they're in post-production right now, and cutting the movie together. So it's amazing that, you know, it does happen. And I can't wait to see it.
That is fantastic. That's great. I can't wait to see it either. Although I'm not familiar with the term porn, but so you sort of gave us a brief description of what's next. So anything else in the percolating in the oven, or your next book? Did your next book have a title? Do you even want to say it?
Well, the working title is called Black Walnut.
Black Walnut.
That's a name. Black Walnut. It's the name of a very small community in northeastern Pennsylvania where my Deep Winter took place. And this one's a mystery, and it's a different. A different ship to steer between a thriller or a suspense story and a mystery. So this one is a mystery, and it's about a alcoholic pastor that discovers a dead body outside of his church. But I don't reveal, you know, who's dead and obviously who killed them. And I spin back, and it's really the 2 weeks leading up to that discovery, and I introduce all these other characters that might have motive to do something awful, and might have been they might be the victim. So,
wow,
that's my story.
That's different.
Is it?
That is really, yeah. That's different. So you're going to be the ending. You'll be learning who's dead and who killed him or her.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Wow, that's really
kind
interesting.
Of a bookend. Yeah.
All right, can't wait to read that one. Maybe what?
Well, you'll be receiving an ARC very soon.
Good. Send it out. I'll be happy to look at it. That'd be great. All right. Well, thanks for stopping in. I know you have to go back and swim across back to the island where you don't get phone reception too well. But I
gotta
really
go
appreciate
feed the deer.
That's right. That's right. Better than what you said you were going to do earlier with the deer before we went on air. But I appreciate you coming on, and when the next book comes out, if you want, we'll have you on again, and I will ask you, does the story pursue you, or do you pursue it? Yeah, I'm going to say that one.
And I will pontificate on that point.
All right. Yeah, take a long time, too.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me,
You bet. You'll be at Left Coast Crime in Vancouver, right?
Yes, I will definitely be there.
All right, good deal. I will see you there. Thanks for coming in, and I'll probably be back, folks, out there in about 2 weeks. I'm not sure who my guest is going to be. I got a couple people lined up. Got to figure out who. But I will be talking at you then. This is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.